So hi everybody, can you hear me okay? Is everything working okay? Okay, it's good to see you all. Happy New Year and welcome back to our ongoing study of the Lamb Room. So please just get comfortable in your seat, adjust your posture, let your body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself, just relax into awareness. And let the whole ground beneath you appear to be completely pure, as level as the palm of your hand, soft and smooth as lapis lazuli. Imagine the space surrounding is filled with offerings. And then in the space in front of you is appearing Lama Tsongkhapa. He's surrounded by many other enlightened beings. And we recollect that we are really, really fortunate to still be alive and to have the leisure and opportunity to engage in a spiritual path that is meaningful to us. So things do not exist as they seem to. And though things are not quite right, we have met a spiritual friend. And this friend of ours is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. So to purify ordinary appearances, try to see yourself to be as clear as a deity holding a vajra and bell. I think that you're going to make this offering of practice and purely for the benefit of all sentient beings. And with that as our motivation, please join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I think that from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa and the spiritual entourage that surrounds them, lights and nectars pour from the heart of each being. And they wash over us and over all the sentient beings surrounding us. And our negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Our lifespan is increased. And our virtues and realizations are similarly increased. Made stronger. We're cleansed by wisdom, compassion, and love. Recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. And to decide to develop these yourself and help as a means to establish all beings within these states. So to affirm this wish of ours, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And in response to this wish of ours, again, lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of Lama Tsongkhapa and the entourage. And these stream down and dissolve into ourselves and all beings surrounding us. And again, the imprints and obstructions that produce suffering are swept away. And in their absence, our lifespan, our health, our virtues and realizations all increase. Then we invite the field for accumulating our merit, for purification, and for the increase of merit. And before them we say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Let us stop ourselves from clinging to our body, our speech and mind, the virtues we've created, the world around us. We imagine that through the power of our wisdom, realizing emptiness, that everything is utterly transformed into a pure land. And we're going to offer this pure land to Lama Tsongkhapa. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all beings enjoy this pure land. Yidam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamaratayami. We've released the offering. The Buddha accepts it with joy. He looks at us and smiles. And we look up into the eyes of the Buddha and find immense humility, a kindness and acceptance. And think that our inner space surrounding you, the enlightened beings all sort of merge into the central figure of Lama Tsongkhapa. An emanation leaves his heart and moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head. And descends and comes down to your heart. Whereby the emanation begins to expand, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars, which now pour out through the pores of your skin. And they begin to fill the entire space surrounding you, transforming any being which exists within space into the enlightened state of Lama Tsongkhapa. Acknowledge that there's no difference between yourself and other. In fact, at this level, self and other are just conceptions, mere names, having no true existence whatsoever. So you just rest in the deepest nature of all phenomena. You think that all these light rays return from the 10 directions of space and re-enter your heart. And you can sort of feel the seat beneath you. You know that you're breathing normally and naturally. But all the objects of the senses now reappear. And you acknowledge that this is a meditation of imagination. Nevertheless, it's imprinted the mind with this type of behavior, with this action that we've taken. So it's definitely sort of nourished the seed for enlightenment. And so I think that one day we will become enlightened, and we will be able to actually help all beings in the way that's most appropriate and best for them. And then just let a sense of joy arise, thinking, thank goodness, you know, I've achieved the purpose of this life and all future lives. I'm able to help others effortlessly, spontaneously, knowing that others really are merely existing. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and just let your eyes flutter open. So again, welcome everybody. Let's have a look at what we've got today. Let's have a look. Now I know, okay, so we have our first question before I turn the slide over. This is, if a person or yourself perceptually realizes the lack of inherent existence of a reflection, is one necessarily an Arya being? So we'll just go down one person by person. So if we can recognize, if we perceptually realize a lack of inherent existence of a reflection, is one necessarily an Arya being?
So no.
Okay, Adelma?
I had yes.
Okay, Bruce, yes or no? We're going to go either way.
I had yes and no. I found cases for both in the commentary.
Okay.
So I think I landed on yes in there.
Okay. Linda.
Right. Yeah, Ken, I said yes. Kenzie Rinpoche said very clearly that if they have perceptual realization of emptiness, they are therefore an Arya being.
Yeah, well,
that's what he said in his commentary.
Yeah. And Caroline, what do you think?
Yeah, well, like Linda, page 21, the Kenzie Rinpoche says yes if it's perceptual, but then I didn't understand that sort of, because all the other things around mirrors and reflections, there's to say suddenly that it's a perceptual realization of what a reflection is. But anyway, yes is what I came down with, because Kenji Rinpoche said so, but no was my instinct.
Yeah, so the tricky word here is, of course, is this word perceptual, eh? So I first originally went, yeah, because it's perceptual. So again, you can see we've got a number of yeses, and Sue and I have got no. So we might have to take this up again. And like I said, I thought, yeah, if you just took it like this word perceptual, I thought, well, if he's perceptually realized emptiness, that's it, isn't it? You're an Arya. Whether it's you realize the emptiness of reflections or persons or any other phenomena. But anyway, I ended up on the no side too, so we have to check this out again. You know, but like I said, I think it really has to do with the word perception.
What's your reasoning for saying no, Eddie?
It was realizing that a reflection is not a real place. Real face does not make one an Arya being.
One of the AI answers that I got that said no. It said, to be an Arya, one must have a direct non-conceptual perception of the emptiness in meditative equipoise. And you're not looking at meditative equipoise if you're saying, oh, there's the mirror. You're not in meditative equipoise. But still, I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's just say we're unsure. Right? Because here's the material we're going through, of course. And I come up with like a no, but again,
the commentary, it's a tricky question.
Yeah.
Go, Bruce.
The commentary said that in order to become a noble being, one must have perceptual knowledge that all phenomena lack inherent existence. So it hinges on perceptual. And then later on it says if someone perceptually realizes the emptiness of a reflection, they necessarily have perceptually realized the emptiness and therefore are an Arya.
An Arya being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it seems to be implying if you perceptually realize the emptiness of the reflection, ergo, you you realize the perceptually realize the emptiness of all phenomena.
Of all phenomena, I think. And so, Sue, what was your, did you come up, what did you come up for having a no?
I thought it was really quiet.
Well, just 1 minute. I'm just going to check something out here. Oh, okay. You keep going, Sue. Yeah.
I thought it was quite tricky because of the
Yes.
wording.
Yes.
And I just thought perception, you can see that it lacks the finer level of non-inherent existence because it's dependent on causes and conditions. You can see that if your face isn't there, then there's no reflection, so it's empty there. But you haven't been in, like Carolyn said, in meditative equipoise, sitting there thinking about analyzing ultimately that it is not inherently existent, not existent by way of its own characteristics, and it doesn't exist from its own side. So that's a perceptual realization of emptiness. But yeah, that's, to me, the question was tricky in the way that it was worded
Yeah.
because perception can mean visual as well. So yeah.
And couldn't
Anyway.
we relate that also to saying that if we realize that the sun is still behind the rain clouds, that we've had a perceptual realization of emptiness? I mean, I think that's just taking it too far, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yes.
That's
Yes. But
quite
I mean, if you can say, oh, I've had a perceptual realization because I realize the reflection in the mirror is emptiness, then you could also relate that to everything else that you're seeing that is quite obvious on a conceptual level, but have we perceptually realized it?
I agree, gentlemen.
Because when I look at this now, I'm saying if so, the first part, if one perceptually realizes the lack of inherent existence of a reflection, so you can say, okay, so a reflection is a phenomena. So like if one perceptually realizes the lack of inherent existence of phenomena, is one necessarily an Ari being? Then you have to say yes. Again, so just my answer here, I don't know. I could be wrong, but like I said, all hinges on this thing, this term, the phrase, isn't it? Perceptually realizes the lack of inherent existence. So you can't, you don't perceptually realize the lack of inherent existence with your set with your ordinary senses. That's not that doesn't happen. Like you say, it only happens within meditative equipoise, and you're doing it with your mental consciousness. So if you realize the emptiness of any phenomena, well, it's what the perceptually you realize it, you are an Arya being, aren't you? So this answer here could be mistaken on my side, but we could take it further.
The only way you could tell is if your afflictive obscurations were all gotten rid of by realizing that. So,
Well, yes, that's what they
or
often
some of
say,
them.
isn't it? So you have to
Yeah.
actually realize it first before you can go the other way
Yeah.
back out.
But I thought that only a Buddha was able to see phenomenon and both see them conventionally and see the nature of their emptiness. If they were not in meditative equipoise, I thought until you became a Buddha, it was only in meditative equipoise that you actually can see, the emptiness of
Sure.
phenomena, but out of meditative equipoise. And so, if this is a situation where they are out of meditative equipoise, then the answer would be no. If they were in meditative equipoise, the
So
answer would
I
be yes.
disagree, Carolyn. See, the realization of when you're in meditative equipoise should carry across to when you're not in it. So that's why they say you see things to be like in illusions or reflections. So this is why this mirror, this idea of a reflection is a very good, useful, phenomena to show us that things don't inherently exist. So
But
it's true. You directly see in meditative equipoise, you perceive the emptiness. You're right. When you come out, if you're not a Buddha, when you come out, everything will go back to appearing inherently existent. But you realize it doesn't have it. You know that. You've discovered it. That's the thing. And this is the weird thing, isn't it? This is like a contradiction between appearances and reality. So when you're out of it, it's like, holy heck, it's come back again. But we realize it's not true. So the clinging has to die down there. Like, you wouldn't just sort of go back to clinging again, would you?
So realizing it's not true, it truly existent,
yeah,
is that a perceptual realization of emptiness?
Yes. So you've got two. We have the non-perceptual, where it's conception, like where we are probably now, like trying to work it out and going, okay, it has to be correct. And I sat down and I did this meditation, and when I do it, the whole objects just vanish. You know, their appearance of true existence vanished, so they don't have it. But yet, when I come out of it, it appears they do have it. So the idea is to take the what we understood on the cushion back out into life. Right? So what we realized on the cushion was the lack of inherent existence. Then we come back in here, so wow, it's a dependent arising. It's an appearance, but it's empty. Because when I was in meditative equipoise, I was looking at the appearance, at my appearances, to see if they had the true existence they seemed to have. And they didn't have it. Now, when I come out, my ordinary senses, Jesus, it's all back to like it was before. Oh, so, for example, right, Diamond Cutter Sutra explains this beautifully and simply. Eh? In fact, we do this for lots and lots of phenomena. We could say, I'll do a couple. One is this really the simple one from the Zen tradition, where it says, you know, in the beginning, when I was practicing, I saw all the mountains, streams. In the middle of my practice, there were no mountains and streams. At the end of my practice, there were mountains and streams. So what he's saying is like the first one, at the beginning of my practice were mountains and streams. He's saying the mountains and streams all appeared to me through my conventional awarenesses as if they were inherently existent. But then, when I went down to see if that were the case, there were no mountains and streams that inherently existed. But what did I discover? Their ultimate nature, their emptiness. At that time, there were no mountains and streams. Yet when I came out, there were the mountains and streams. But the mountains and streams he saw when he came out were not the same mountains and streams before he went in. Right? There's another one where they go, take the mind. There is no mind. It's clear and knowing. Listen, there's another one from Diamond Cutter Sutra. We say, take the mind, the conventional nature of mind. What's it appear to be? Like ordinarily, we say inherently existent. Ah, so I've got to have a look for the inherently existent mind. There was no inherently existent mind. I could not find the mind within its parts. When I came out, it's clear and knowing. That's how it exists. It just exists as a convention, as a name. But when we, like I said, when we went in, it didn't appear to be just a name. It was like real.
I was just going back to that. If that's all the case, why would Kensa Rinpoche very clearly say, if he's had a perceptual realization of lack of inherent existence, it's necessarily an Arya being?
Yes, because that'd be it, wouldn't it? If you have, like I said, it all depends on this phrase. If this is the case, then of course whether you realize a reflection or the self, it doesn't matter what it is. If you have a perceptual realization of its emptiness, you're an Arya being. Right? But this is more to do with like what Caroline was talking about this idea of, but hang on a minute, don't you actually only perceive that when you're a Buddha? I said, no, because you can perceive it, you know, when you do your meditation. But then when you come out, of course, it looks just the same as it did before you went in, except you know it's not.
So that's what sort of I'm struggling with. You come out and you know it's not inherently existent, but is that still a perceptual realization?
No, not at that time there. No, you're back on the conventional level again.
Right.
But what you realize has to inform the conventional.
Yeah.
And how it informs it, we say it's merely named.
So would you say that in this example then, to be the yes, it's
yeah.
saying that the aria in a meditative equipoise on emptiness perceptually realized that a reflection lacks inherent existence, and when they came out, they still remembered that it, you know, it was...
That's right.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
That's right. So still, they remember this, they know this thing doesn't have the...
Yeah,
way
yeah.
Its existence and appearance are not in harmony.
Yes. Okay, I'm yes.
Okay. Oh my God.
So, Eddie, can I just ask a question?
Sure.
So you know, on retreat, you got you're close to being an RUB, you meditate, you look outside your window and you see all this stuff, you know. And then you obviously, when you're in meditative equipoise, you haven't got your eyes closed, obviously, because...
You don't need your eyes closed.
No, you don't have your eyes closed. You've got your eyes open.
Yeah.
So that means that those things that you can see out of your window are no longer there. You can't see them. They lose all of their appearance.
Now you're not really looking... You're not looking at them through your...
Visual senses.
Visual senses.
Your mental.
No,
okay.
you're considering it through your mental.
Right. So they... Yeah, okay.
This is why it's often said it's harder to do it with phenomena than with self. And they say, just start with yourself. It's a much easier phenomena to work with.
Okay.
Objects of the senses. And once you get that, it's quite easy to go, oh, my gosh.
You okay.
Know, which we see in the questions as we go along.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Eddie.
Okay. Okay, what's this? Next question is, why is the reflection a good example to use for the following syllogism? So, guys, I might have moved these questions around a little bit just to try to make it flow a bit better. I'm not sure, but I know I have done it in one of these classes. So the question I've put up is, why is a reflection a good example to use for the following syllogism? Take the person. It lacks inherent existence because it is a dependent arising, and then you give the example, you know, like a reflection. So, Sue, what would you like, anything you can say about this? Why is the reflection a good example?
In an example, in a syllogism, you've always got to give something that's easier to realise than the actual thing you're trying to prove. So it is kind of easier to realise, and there's no debate over, although we've just had a big debate about it, over, you know, the dependent arising of a reflection in a mirror. It doesn't lead to infinite progression, like of regression, that you start
okay.
debating that.
So in a sentence, just so if you could say reflection is a good example because...
It's easier to realise.
It's easier to realise? Okay, Adelma?
I had it's easier to understand that a reflection doesn't exist in the way it appears by actually knowing that it's a dependent arising. So you get at it that way.
Okay, Bruce?
Along the same lines, you don't have to perceptually realise emptiness to understand the reflection is empty of inherited existence. It's a good, easily understand example.
Okay, so I'm just going to say the syllogism again. Take a person. It lacks inherent existence because it is a dependent arising, for example, like a reflection. Yeah. Linda, did you have a go at this?
Yeah, so I would say that it's easy to see that I'm not in the mirror. So even though it looks like I'm in the mirror, I'm not in the mirror,
okay.
And I know that. It's really easy to see that. And
okay.
Also I know that when I move out of the row of the mirror, then I disappear from the mirror. And when I come back in, I come back in. So I can see that I'm a dependent arising. So I have to actually be in front of the mirror, otherwise I don't arise.
Okay, excellent. Good. Caroline?
Yeah. Yeah, I came on it from the dependent arising thing. It's easy to see that your reflection depends on you being in the scope of the mirror instead of being able to reflect and having a mirror there in the first place. So without those two things, there is no reflection.
Yeah, so I understand that saying that it's a good example because it's a common experience of something that is both vividly appearing and obviously not existing in the way it appears. So it's very much like you're saying, Linda. It's obvious it's there, but you're not in the mirror. Right? So it's vividly appearing. Like you say, you look at reflections, they like appear to be in the mirror, don't they? You know, like I appear to be you know, in the mirror, but we know we're not. And the thing is, it perfectly illustrates dependent arising. Yeah, because the mirror, because the reflection of a mirror looks just like you, but it's not you. So things appear inherently existence, but they're not. So a reflection is a good example to use like that. Something appears intrinsically existent, but it's not. And we know it's not, like you're saying, because it dependently arises. Now the next question I've got is like, is the reflection not existing in the way it appears the emptiness of the reflection? Sue, would you like to go first on this? It's either yes or no, isn't it? Again, is the reflection not existing in the way it appears the emptiness of the reflection? Sue says no. Delma? Is it a no? No?
No. No.
No. Good. Bruce, you're a yes or no? No? Anyone say yes?
I said no, yes. Okay. I shook my head like this, but I
said no. That's right. Not existing in the way it appears, eh, Delma? You're trying to show me through living example. I'm saying, I'm not a gallows, but say no. Yeah, anyway, that is the answer, right? Yeah, not existing in the way it appears is only like what you say, the gross emptiness of the reflection. And next question is, why? Now, this is an interesting one. So why? Why is this emptiness of the, why is not existing in the way it appears, not the emptiness?
It's like Linda said, it's a conventional refutation. And yeah. It's accessible to everybody. Like you can jump in front of the mirror and back and forth and see it.
Yeah, this is right. Yeah. Delma, but basically that's summed it all up. That's really the answer, right? That's all we're navigating, isn't it? We're not in the mirror, but that's not emptiness. Okay, let's do our first meditation. So just get comfortable in your seats. So the idea behind this meditation is to explore the reflection in the mirror to reveal how things exist. So we're sitting upright, our gaze is softened, we're releasing tensions and relaxing. And the breath is flowing naturally. So now just establish an altruistic intention to realize the nature of reality. So have you ever noticed how a reflection appears vivid and real, yet possesses not a single atom of the object it depicts? The reflection appears vivid and real, it possesses not a single atom of the object it depicts. So this suggests that while phenomena appear to the mind, they are entirely They entirely lack or are without an independent and solid substance. So grasping at things to be truly there binds us to anxiety, to worry. Well, if we could just acknowledge their transparency, this would allow the heart and mind to rest. So like a reflection in a clear mirror, our sense of self appears to function without ever existing from its own side. So why does the world seem so concrete if it's empty of any real substance? Well, just as a movie on a screen seems like a solid world, but it's only a play of light. All appearances depend upon causes. So is it possible to find the real object when we look closely at the parts that supposedly make it up? So peeling away the layers of an onion reveals no central core. Just as searching for a solid and real self finds only empty and interrelated parts. So what would happen to our habitual fears and attachments when we realize the things we fear or have attachment towards have no inherent power to harm or to please? Well, the sky, clear of clouds, reveals a vast unobstructed space which mirrors the mental clarity that arises, you know, when the fogs and mists of ignorance dissolve. Let's try to carry this insight into the rest of the day. View interactions as a sort of a magical empty display of dependent arising. And consider the world to be sort of a vibrant dance of appearances, lacking any solid foundation. And breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale. Wow, so I just noticed the funny thing that happened with me when I said that last line, you know. I said, the world is a vibrant dance of appearances, lacking any solid foundation. And my mind just went straight to, yep, but isn't the mind the foundation? And then I went, you can't find the mind when you look for it, eh? You don't find the mind in the appearances, it's not there. So it's like, oh man, it wasn't that. I'm like, whoop, you go in, you hop back out again. Yeah, no. Okay, so here come our next.
But just ask a question. So what struck me was there's no inherent power to harm. So yeah. The having read news feeds before I came on, the harm that's happening across the world then comes from what the harmful afflictions in the minds of people and the causes and conditions and all of that.
Yeah, that's right, Carla. I was speaking to one of the students the other day. Now, she's been going on the marches for peace and these sort of things, and this struck me, like, how can you have, we want the world to be peaceful, but the parts that make up this world are not peaceful. How's that, how can we have a peaceful world? I mean, like, if the mind is not peaceful, I mean, if you look for this phenomena called peace, what where is that?
And it was an instructive reply Geshe-Sherib gave to what's happening in the world is both individual and collective karma. So every one of us has contributed the energy from our collective karma to what's happening in the world. I think it
Absolutely.
was a good reminder about collective karma and the energy from it. I thought the energy was an important aspect that he mentioned there.
Yeah, okay. So it's so what's our first, it says our questions. When we talk about seeing that what the self owns also lacks inherent existence, what is being referred to as what the self owns? So Sue, what does the self own?
One's own aggregates.
Say that again. The
One's own
aggregates.
aggregates.
Aggregates, okay. I takes to be theirs. Okay, Dharma?
I've got grasping at the aggregates as well.
Yeah, five aggregate subjects. So everybody should have, like, basically the five aggregates. So there's basically, in the broadest sense, what the self owns refers to everything we identify with. But in this case, we're talking about specifically the five aggregates. So I was thinking about this answer, I was thinking, wow, yeah, that's right. Like, we think, like the car is mine, isn't it? There's lots of things that are like beyond the aggregates. So oh, that's mine, this is, and then when we identify with them, geez, you better look at it, somebody touches the car, isn't it? We jump out and go grabbing at mine. Yeah. But here, this is not that thing. This is a real big broad one. Here, the real answer is, of course, these five aggregates. Now, the next question is, a reifying view is necessarily grasping at the self of persons. What two aspects are included within this reifying view? So I think everybody will have the answer to this, won't they? It's like, this is, I mean, this is not a hard one, it's right in the text, right? It's these two aspects. We're grasping at I or me, and then grasping at mine. And so this,
Eddie, can you just remind me what rarefying, what's the
like a
definition of
reifying view.
rarefying?
Reifying view. It's such a good term, isn't it? Because the reifying view is just the view that grasps at phenomena to be truly existent or inherently existent. That's the reifying view. That's what it does. Right? In fact, it could just correspond to inherent existence, where you look, the phenomena appears to exist without depending upon anything. So there, now we have the object reified. Which, like you say, that's inherent existence, isn't it? Something could exist without depending upon anything. I mean, and that's how the phenomena appear to us, but then there's this grasping at it, which is the belief that it is so. Got these two aspects. So what's the next one? It says the reifying view is necessarily grasping at the self of persons. What two aspects are included within this? We've got that. And then what's the first aspect of the reifying view? Grasping at I or grasping at mine? Okay, Sue, would you like to try this one first?
The first aspect of grasping inherently exists in I. It apprehends the person or the self as the agent that appropriates and acts upon the aggregates, and also as the accumulator or experiencer of karma.
Nicely said. Okay, good. Dhamma.
Mine was just so much more simpler than Sue's.
Yes.
I just said that it's actually grasping that I exist permanently and solidly and from its own side, so as an inherent existent.
Okay, yep. Bruce.
Much the same, the grasping itself of persons.
Just that the I is imputed onto its space of designation, its aggregates, and its sense consciousness. It also said it's the appropriator, the subject, and it does not inherently exist under ultimate analysis.
Okay, and Caroline.
Yes, I had it was, the view of oneself as solid, independent, self-sufficient, and the what I read something the other day, which I like, which was the perpetrator and the experiencer of karma.
Okay, so here's another answer. The mistaken belief that there is a substantial and independent identity at the center of our experiences. A little bit of writing to go along with this. It says, grasping at I or me is the fundamental habit of mind that Buddhist philosophy identifies as the very root of all of our suffering. It's not a philosophical theory. It's a deep gut-level feeling we have every moment of our lives. This is the innate mistaken belief that there is a solid, separate I or me that exists independently of our body, thoughts, and feelings. This self is felt to be the owner of our experiences, or, my thoughts, and the one to whom things happens. This is happening to me. This grasping is the root of all suffering because it creates a false division between me and the world, leading directly to attachment aversion and taking everything personally. It's the constant, subtle, and unquestioned assumption that there is a solid, independent, and continuous me at the center of my experience. It's what they say, the boss, the owner. This, thing. We've all felt this, haven't we? I'm sure we have. We all felt it's a real me, and it's not my body, and it's not my mind I'm talking about. Yeah, and it's independent. It seems to be not dependent. So I read something the other day. I thought, wow, that's a great sort of analysis, a check, a really quick one. Well, if you think if you, I mean, we have this belief idea, right? So substantial and independent. But then if you think, okay, well, if you wish to, so if I wish to hurt you, what do I have to do to hurt you? Or if you wanted to hurt me, what would you have to do?
Body or my mind?
Sorry? That's right. You have to go through the body or mind. It's the only way to hurt the person, isn't it? Lindy, you just switched off, mate. Say more.
No, I didn't realize I was on when I said that.
Oh, okay. No, it's
Sorry.
true. That's exactly right.
Oh, okay.
That's why you can't be, you're not, you cannot be independent of the body or mind. Because to hurt me, you have to hurt my body or my mind. And now I'm hurt. Right? So obviously we're not like independent of the body and mind. This is the easy one, isn't it? Then we go, geez, I must be. And so next we grasp that next, isn't it? Okay, well, I'm not independent, then I've got to be the body and mind. And that would be like the grasping at the phenomena, wouldn't it? That's me. But here we're just grasping at me, being a self independent of it all. Now, Alex, what's the first aspect? So we've just done that. What is the second aspect of the reifying view? grasping it mine.
It apprehends my own aggregates as inherently possessed by the eye.
Man. So this is like this thing I found out. I was saying, telling Sue as we began, like this is bad. It takes place. This is not good. Abdelma, what would you say?
I had that it's grasping at things that belong to me, like parts
Yeah,
of
that's
my
great.
aggregates and everything else.
Okay. Bruce.
Grasping at phenomena.
Okay, grasping at the phenomena. In such a way that what? That you grasp at the phenomena?
Sorry, in relation to the self.
Yeah, so to grasp at the phenomena to be me.
Or mine.
Or mine. Yeah, well, this. So it's funny, when you go like mine again, yeah, we have this independent self that's owning the things. Right? But we found, oh, okay, I'm not. There is no independent self out there, so that one's off. So the mine is me. Linda.
I don't know that I can add anything more to that. It is
That,
just
that's
such
good,
right,
that's
you
fine.
know, like, yeah,
If you get it,
those things are me.
that's it. That's basically it. That's right. Caroline?
Yeah, I suppose it was in the way that there's an I, and the I has the body and mind and belonging. So there's some sort of separation, because I'm the king, queen, pin, and these are mine. So in a way that's sort of separate from me.
So again, so this is like you come back to this one, is it? An I separate and independent. So we could grasp at the phenomena, we quickly come back to grasping at I again, don't we? I'll just put it, whatever I have. This is the mistaken belief that our body, mind, and possessions are who we are. So, you know, so this is really, I found this really interesting, especially after yesterday. You know, when we look at how we define ourselves, right? The I is the person is what? The I that's merely imputed to the four or five aggregates. That sentence means different things to different philosophical systems, doesn't it? You know, because the systems beneath the middle way consequence will go, there's got to be, there's something, that's me. So what could it possibly be? It's me. So none of them is going to say the body. They're going to just go, no, I'm not. I'd never go like that. Right? Because if you were the body, then it follows that then there's no rebirth and all that sort of thing. So many of the other systems that are lower than the middle way consequence will often say, you know, we are the continuum, or we are a type of mind. Right? But as you know, the middle way consequence will not go along with that. They understand, yes, you say that and so forth. But what we're saying is the I is a mere name, is the label given to those five aggregates. That's what, you know, in terms of our identity, the I is just the name put onto the base called the five aggregates. Now, these are the parts of the person. The name I is identity we give to it. So I'm thinking, okay, that's correct. But what happens is a clinging takes place between the name and the basis. You know, we think that this is me. This is who I am. And you've got the two on. One is the side that's merely imputed. It now seems to be like something real but independent of it. Like I said, like the owner, the possessor. So that's one way of grasping and clinging, which is a mistake. The other is to, like you say, take these things to be mine. And I say, man, you'd like, oh boy. So it's like saying this thing, so what? You want to take this, what we call this massive suffering, to be you. You want to identify with that. Oh, it's terrible, eh? It's terrible. I found I've been doing this for so long, and suddenly I just realized, shit, this is what they mean. The deepest level of suffering, it's like not just ordinary pain and ordinary happiness. It's no, right down, there's this phenomena called the body and mind of the person. What do we call it? Contaminated and appropriated. Jesus. It's contaminated with past, previous actions, the wrong ideas and everything. And then we appropriate, we grab it. We go, that's me. Instead of just relaxing and going, no, I'm just an I imputed to it. I'm just a label going along with a whole lot of other labels. Because if you look beneath all that, it's this label, isn't it? Boy, but I was like, it's really rocked me. That's what I've been doing. And it's really interesting. What I found, I said, oh my God, like, that's me, then, but everybody else is like that too. Everyone's doing the same thing. So we're all holding on to this body and mind. And I think it's in the Four Noble Truths where they say, mistaking contamination for purity. They say, we mistake the impermanent to be permanent. We mistake the impure to be pure. But, oh, fuck. Jesus, that's, yes. Ah.
It's almost like you have to actually come to that thought, Eddie, to get that really strong basis of equanimity so that we can then work on all the rest of the steps to get ultimate bodhicitta. Because unless we sort of get to that, it's sort of, it's, you don't have that drive, do you, to get out of it or to help others get out of it.
The other thing that struck me down was you don't know how deep other people's suffering and the suffering is that other people experience if you don't if you, don't acknowledge this. But just as they've been clinging to their body and mind to be them. Like clinging to a massive suffering to be me. Well, how can you not suffer if you're going to do that? It's like picking up fire. We know it burns us, and we just hold on to it. Okay, here I am.
Wow, that's amazing, Eddie. We forget there's hope and there's a way out sometimes, don't we?
Yes, but there's this lovely thing in it. So I looked at that and I went, yeah, but there's the next two parts of being empty and selfless. You've got to go, yeah, there's no real me in there, remember? And I'm not really it. I'm just the name given to it. But if I forget that, I'm going to cling. I'm going to grab it like it is me. And I am in there. And then all the rest follows. Remember
Eddie,
to
oh,
do.
sorry.
Sorry, go.
I've just noticed that as soon as you start to feel any sort of disturbance in the mind, you almost always know that this is the reason why, because you've decided that you're not just a label. You really are a thing. And this is why the mind gets disturbed, which is basically does it all the time.
We cling to
And
the
this is the
appearances.
reason. And it's like, yeah, because I'm not that, but I think I am. And that's why my mind is now so disturbed by what's
Still,
happening around me, Oh,
yeah,
yeah. So,
yes, that's
yeah.
right.
And when everybody else is buying into it, we get swept up in it.
That's right. That's right. Like, yeah, so every time we buy in, every time we forget, then it sets it off again, doesn't it? I remember this, Rabina was saying, it's just quite really strong. So going, it's suffering by nature, Eddie, by nature. And I'm just sort of going like, shit, when I hear that name word nature, I think inherent existence. It's just, if that's the case, there's just no way out. But of course, it's empty too. The suffering is empty. We're empty. The whole thing is empty of any true existence. And so the freedom is there all the time, but it's only becomes apparent when we stop the clinging, when we stop grasping. Then the freedom reveals itself. Okay, next one is,
But you still just on that, Eddie, you still have to, work at the conventional level. And, as everyone knows, that sort of with my work on the Four Immeasurable Attitudes, I still remind people to rejoice and not sort of, and be kind to themselves and compassionate. And not when you do feel you're suffering a disturbed mind, to also go into, that mode of, kind of joy that we are here online, that we are doing, we are concerned about sort of, achieving bodhicitta, that what we do at the conventional level to benefit others and be kind and to ourselves. So I think you have to balance that as well.
Yeah, well, I take this. What I felt after this was that it's like the first teachings we get is one of the teachings of restraint. You say, okay, so this is this. We've got this massive suffering that we're calling me. The first thing is stop hurting yourself. Right? Restrain yourself from hurting yourself. So that's where the Four Immeasurables come in, Caroline. Right? It's like okay. So what goes against loving kindness? You go anger, hatred. You'll hurt yourself. You'll stimulate. You just drive it. You just set yourself off more and more. So don't do that. Let's work where we can with kindness. So we don't add more suffering, to the pile. So at the conventional level, yes, that's exactly what we should do. Because when we find out through our analysis that, the wisdom realizing emptiness just tells that everything is a dependent arising. And so this ball of suffering is dependent. Which means that, again, it doesn't truly exist. So this is, one of the books of Holiness is Take Suffering. There is no suffering. This is called suffering. So there's no inherently, because we start off with inherent suffering, we discover, oh my God, suffering's actually empty, but it does exist in name. It's not like non-existent. It exists by being designated, called that. And sort of everything's like that. So this is this lovely thing, and I was thinking about this morning, thinking, I used to feel really sort of heavy and depressed thinking about or hearing this term by nature. And I was thinking, from the viewpoint of an unenlightened being, of course it's like this. But from the viewpoint of restraining, stopping causing suffering, looking deeper into it, we've got the other side. It's the flip side, isn't it? The emptiness of suffering is nirvana. Describing that suffering has no true existence is called nirvana. So the peace is there, but it's subject to not clinging.
That's nice, Eddie, because nature is equivalent or synonymous to entity. And so, therefore, suffering by entity, if you're not identifying with it, if you're not saying the name is it,
Yep.
then it's not.
It's not. So I really like it. It's like it's coming out from the reified view. Then you find, oh, it's empty of that. How does it? Oh, dependently. It's not reified. It's empty of that. You come out the end, it's dependent. And the most subtle dependence is name. It's just called that. Okay, we have a next question, which is holding my I, this object, my I, to exist inherently a reifying view or a grasping at the self of phenomena? Is holding my I to exist inherently? So we're reifying the I. Anyway, I'll just put it up like this. So if you guys have different answers, tell me, please. So when we grasp at the I itself, we're grasping at a self of phenomena. This is like the idea of the reflection, isn't it? It's a self of phenomena. But the reifying view is grasping at mind, which is like, me, the owner of the I.
It's tied to self. That's what my
Oh,
AI
yes.
said.
Yeah,
That's
that's right.
nice.
So here's my, okay, now I've got a little interesting thing. So this is where we can raise anything you'd like to, and I mean, we've been doing a bit of chatting anyway. So I had this funny thing.
In that last one, I landed on the latter, the grasping itself of a phenomena. But just as you read out the question again, Eddie, I thought it's both really, isn't
Yeah, you can see aspects of both, can't you? For sure. Yeah. It's not one or the other, is it? It's no. It's both take place. Okay, so let's do our next meditation, and then I think we should have a little break. So please, just get comfortable in your seats, folks. Then just allow your gaze to soften, release the tension from your shoulders, and feeling supported by your seat, just relax and let your breath flow naturally. And then now just establish an altruistic intention to realize the nature of reality. So just observe how the mind instinctively feels that there is a findable, autonomous controller sitting behind your eyes or in your heart. Now we call this the watcher. And this watcher appears to be like real and findable. If you believe this to be the case, this is the reifying view, and it's the root of all cyclic existence. And it binds us to repeated sufferings and confusion. So like clouds, adventitiously obscuring an open sky, these afflictions grasp, the afflictive grasps temporarily, so that these hide the mind's true na empty nature, but just temporarily. Now, if the I exists inherently, can it be found as something separate from your physical and mental parts? Our analysis reveals no self existing apart from the aggregates. Yet the mind still projects a solid and independent entity called I. Now, this is like a reflection in a mirror. It appears to be, just like the mirror, when you look in the mirror, appears to be a real face, but it doesn't have any face essence. Now, could the I be the same as the body or the collection of thoughts you're having now? So if the I were the same as the parts, then there would be many persons, many I's. That'd be one consequence. Another consequence would be when a thought ended, you would end. But this doesn't take place. If you think about a car, the car is not the wheels or the axle. It's not the window screen or the doors or the engine. Car is just the label given to the functional arrangement. So how then does the I exist? It cannot be found through searching with ultimate analysis. The I exists nominally and conventionally as a dependent arising. It performs functions without having an intrinsic core. I is merely a label designated to the aggregates. Now, all experiences that we have are very similar to dreams. They feel real while they're occurring, yet they are without any objective substance. So throughout the rest of the day, notice when the I, yourself, feels solid, feels independent, not dependent upon anything. Then remind yourself that the I is a functional label. It's not a findable thing. And you can just rest in the freedom of this insight. And let go of the sort of heavy burden of the self being a truly existing entity. Okay, now breathing in through your nostrils, just exhale. So we have this quite an interesting question next. It asks, what does it mean when the text says that the Buddha does not debate with the world? Sue, would you like to go first on trying to giving us a shot at this?
Buddha debates ultimate reality, but accepts relative truths per common perception. For example, chariots exist conventionally, enabling the middle way to truths without denying function.
Okay, thank you. Delma?
I had the Buddha refers to the conventions that are familiar to the world. Conventionally, things exist. But when we analyse in any of the seven ways, we find that they cannot be found, but they still do conventionally exist.
Okay, excellent. And Caroline?
So the Buddha does not, and the Buddha accepts convention, as others have said, accepts conventional truths as the world defined them for the sake of communication with people, even though he knows, you know, that they lack inherent existence. So he only debates the inherent nature people falsely attribute to these things.
Excellent. And Linda?
I'm not sure there's anything else left to say, really.
I'll do then. So, when it says, what does it mean when the text says the Buddha does not debate with the world? What does it not mean? We're just going through this question here, Bruce. What does it mean when the text says that the Buddha does not debate with the world? If you wouldn't mind, just throw across your answer, and then I'll just, my next question is, what does it not mean?
I had that it means acceptance of conventional existence.
Okay. Things conventionally exist, yes.
I guess it means, what it doesn't mean is acceptance of ultimate existence.
Okay. Before I whack up an answer that I've got up here, so what it does not mean is that the Buddha agrees with the world's mistaken views. So that's, it doesn't mean that. Right? It means that the Buddha accepts the validity of conventional truths for what they are. So I'm not sure. You guys remember the three types of convention? Conventional agreement, conventional truth, conventional existence. They are the three. When we use this word conventional, we've got to remember that these three aspects of it.
Can you repeat them, please, Eddie?
Conventional truth, conventional agreement, conventional existence. So if we look at conventional existence, it means, you know, produced phenomena depend upon causes and conditions. They have parts, and then we call subtle conventional existence. The phenomena exist depend upon their names, upon consciousness and naming. So this is one that most people would forget. Then we have conventional agreement, where we just say, you know, we agree that these phenomena are called cars or flowers. You know, each country has conventions about the names of the phenomena. And this, you know, they're just like agreements that we make as societies and people. So that's a convention. But conventional truth, this is where it gets tricky. So conventional truths are that the phenomena appear to exist inherently. So this is the conventional truth. So you think, okay, so what we think of as conventional truths, they appear to exist inherently, but when we question it, we find that they don't. Worldly people, ordinary people, perceive objects as existing from their own side. This is conventional truth. The Buddha does not accept this inherent existence. However, he does not debate with ordinary people about it on the conventional level, because he accepts that things appear that way to them. Yeah, sort of nice, isn't it? You know, I still play this game with myself. Is, you know, to just hop off a bus or out of a car, and as soon as you like, just look around at something and just say, does the thing appear to exist over there? And you're going to go, of course it does. Well, that's existence from its own side. Right? So we all feel that way. We all apprehend objects that way. But like you know, like we say, do they actually exist from their own side? That's a different story. Now we're looking at conventional existence. Right? So we go, well, heck no, they depend on causes and conditions, parts and name. So they're not there on their own without depending upon, you know, anything whatsoever. So we've got to, this is the thing, it's a tricky sort of thing. You've got to keep switching. You hear this word conventional, go, you know, talk about just common agreements, or are we talking here about how they conventionally exist? And you go, causes, conditions, parts, name. Or are we talking about conventional truth? Because if we are there, then we're now talking about reified existence from its own side, all that sort of stuff, right? And he knows, the Buddha knows, yeah, we all, ordinary people, apprehend all phenomena just like that. And like I said, you check it out on yourself, and you call it, yeah, he's right, it does appear that way to me. I appear like, you know, cut off from the things. They're objects, I'm subjects, they're over there, I'm over here, and so forth. That's, you know, everyone. So he doesn't argue about that. He says, yeah, I know, you all see it like that. That is how it's all appearing to you. but you know, it doesn't actually exist that way. And then we have to go, okay, now we've got to go back to existence. Right? We've got to look at the other level of convention, the conventional existence. Because this is conventional truth. And conventional truths are all appearing inherently existent. You know, ultimate truths show us they're not. Okay, here's our next question. Does a yogi first realize selflessness of persons or selflessness of phenomena? I'm sure you probably get all this correct, so I'll just whack it up here. They start off with a person, right? That's amazing because it's easier and manageable to do this. So, you know, to actually sort of, like I said, the thing is to try and create the appearance of a truly existent self. And a very simple way to do that is to frighten yourself or just have some sort of experience where you sort of think it's me. You know, it's not my body, it's not my mind, it's not my speech, they're getting it at me. So if we get that, that's like, right, great. Okay, there it is. Now, how's it doesn't seem to be my body, it doesn't seem to be my mind, it doesn't seem to depend upon them. In fact, it seems to be existing on its own. So that's quite easy, isn't it? When you look at that, go, okay, well then if it's there, then there's only a couple of things that can happen here, isn't it? Yeah. And once you get that, it's like, you don't, you know, like you're within seconds, you'll go, geez. You know, if that's the case with that, then it follows everything else is like that. And this one says that indirect, not so easy. Because like you say, if you look at, if you're trying to find, you know, like the inherent existence of the phenomena, well, it looks inherently existent straight off. You know that it's separate from you, has its own thing. But like how do you undo that, unwind it? Now, so then they have this, you know, the way that, well, as you'll see later on, is that there's a way of doing that with phenomena, which is a little bit different than doing it with just for the person. Person's a much easier way of working. So the yogi first realizes the selflessness of the person. He says this is because grasping at a solid I is a direct root of suffering. Suffering comes from grasping at a solid sense of self. Therefore, first realize the selflessness of the person. Well, I've heard other people say they find it easier to do phenomena. So I don't think it's like strictly you've got to do self first and then phenomena. I think it's just to say, look, it is easier if you might find it easier to start with yourself because it's easier to get that experience of, oh, there it is, right?
Eddie, my AI said Tsongkhapa says person first, then phenomena.
Yeah.
But it said Chandrakirti says the reverse. Is that right? No, I don't know. That's what it said. Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the things to remember with this is these sort of presentations is to try, we need to always bear in mind what's suitable for the person. So you always get like these things that it's this one and then that one. You know, and sometimes, you know, that you start off with the Four Noble Truths, but then sometimes you start with a different way. And great teachers like His Holiness are really good at doing this sort of thing. I'm not sure. Like the Chandrakirti starts with phenomena, doesn't he? He starts with a chariot.
Yes, he does.
You know? He starts with phenomena. You go, now take this phenomena related to yourself, right? And you are made up of body and mind. It's like the chariot has parts, you have parts. And then check to see if any of these parts have any inherent existence. Okay, this is which phenomena are concentrated upon when one is meditating to realize the selflessness of persons. So I think you guys, you're all going to get at least, we'll see, why don't you tell me first, which phenomena are concentrated upon when one is meditating to realize the selflessness of phenomena?
Perishing aggregates.
Like perishing aggregates. You all agree?
Yeah.
Yep. Is there anything else that they might meditate upon? To realize the selflessness of phenomena.
A vase?
Here we go. the five aggregates, the six elements, and the 12 sources. Any of, or all of them, you don't need to do all of them, but they often do, don't they, to make sure. So you can do the five aggregates that make up the person's imputed to, the six elements that a person's imputed to, or the 12 sources that a person's imputed to. It's just, you know, bigger and larger categories, I guess.
Sorry, Eddie, can you clarify? I've not heard or can't remember what these 12 sources are. Is that the 12 links?
No. So we have the sources are like the senses and what they get at and the consciousnesses that arise when they get at them. So it ends up in, you know, that'd be like that. That's the 18, isn't it? So here is just the six sources and what they produce. And these are basically the basic components of entire perceived world. Yeah, so yeah, in the Heart Sutra, for instance, isn't it? That's where these come up, don't they? Yeah, what is it they say? No form, no feeling, so forth. There's no I element and no object of the I element. So there you've got the I element there and then the objects of them. So you go, okay, none of these things have any, they're all selfless. They all lack an intrinsic nature. Then it says, what is the meditative method recommended to realize the selflessness of phenomena? Bruce, do you remember this one?
The refutation of the four extremes of production.
That's the one, right? And so these four extremes are, of course, do phenomena inherently produce themselves? Or do they depend upon some other inherent object? Or is it a mix of both? Or is there no cause whatsoever? So these all seem to be like extreme ways of looking at production. Anyway, what they mean by extreme is, does production inherently exist? If it does, phenomena produce themselves. Or they depend upon something else that is intrinsically existent. So often, I mean, in the past, when I looked at this, I really thought they were talking about that it wasn't an extreme. They were looking at, you know, conventional phenomena. But it's not. These are phenomena that seem to be intrinsically existent. That's what I call sort of like extreme, right? And so that's the way we look. We go, okay, I'm going to assume they are, and then I'm going to check. Because if they are, then they can only be produced by themselves from something else that also intrinsically exists. Now, like I said, both an intrinsic self and an intrinsic other, or nothing whatsoever. So it's sort of saying that if something arises inherently, it must do so in one of these four exhaustive ways. So when we do the analysis on ourselves, whether we inherently exist, we see ourselves as like we can just do it really simple, just do two, isn't it? It's either inherently the same or inherently different, which is here, inherently the same or inherently different. And we go, no way. These guys, well, let's take it a step further. And then I go, you know, how about inherently self another? What about no cause whatsoever? And you go, no. Okay, no inherent production. Therefore, I can't inherently exist. Okay, so now we've got this. What's interesting? So what I do with this is I grab all the material that has been, you know, that we've got the answers to, we put through, and I whack it through the AI, and I've got a little way of asking it to produce interesting questions. So then I've got quite a lot of them. And I ask of them to ask me interesting questions about Dharma specifically, and then how do I apply this knowledge in ordinary life? So, you know, then, so I get both sides, and it'll produce these questions. And so I'll ask it to ask, find these great questions, have the question answered, and then provide me a simile or an analogy that will demonstrate the answer to make it easier to, hold in my head. Here's this question. Why must we analyze the parts of a person to find self?
I think it's because the parts and the whole, like our aggregates and the I, are interwoven. So therefore, you've got to look where they're interwoven to see if it's there.
Okay. Yes. Okay. That's good, Sue. Anybody else?
Because there is no whole without the parts. They can't be. They're what's the term?
Mutually dependent.
Mutually dependent. I'm thinking mutually exclusive. No, mutually dependent.
No, good. I like that.
Yes.
Yes.
They're mutually dependent, so you can't find one without finding the other, and you can't say one does not exist until we can say the others don't exist as well.
Okay. So I'll give you the answer that the AI provided. It says, to prove that the I is just the label on the body and mind. It's a nice way. Because when you go in there and you find it's not there, you know what, if you didn't know about emptiness and dependent arising, you go, geez, I don't exist. But this is, no, you're not in there. You're imputed to it. You're just a name given to it. So, wow, that's a nice answer. That just shows that we're just merely labelled. We're not in there. We're not. So as a simile, it says, it's like disassembling a watch, to discover that timekeeper is only the name for the parts. Yes, I think, I don't know if I've done this, but I remember doing this as a kid, like looking for the thing inside it. When you're a kid, you're really, curious about things. It's like, well, it's cool. Like, where is it? Like, I got to get in there and have a little look, see, eh? So you take off the glass and get amongst the gears. That look like where's this thing? Of course, you don't find it. You find all these other things, but you don't find the thing you're looking for. it's just called a watch, a timekeeper.
That Dr. Carl has had a program on the ABC about how things are made, and it's such a brilliant example of that. It's sort of like a book. There was one session, a book, ice cream, boots, and these things. You just realise before you that there were just all these parts that had to come together for this thing which got the label.
That's right. That's exactly right. The other thing you might find, there used to be many, many years ago, do you remember that show, the sky used to come on and he'd paint a picture? This is really odd. I'm going back to my sort of childhood. There was this Canadian guy. He'd show that we could all paint. So he'd set up this thing, his canvas, and then get out the brushes, and start painting. Right? And so he, I've started watching it again because it's like, you can see how like the canvas is blank, right? And then he starts moving just these brushes here and there. And then you start going, oh, there's a tree. Oh, that's the sky. They just appear, right? He just goes like this. And then you go, do it. It's like, wow, it's just, how your mind like makes it up dependent upon, the colours and the way he uses his brush and things. And trees appear, like everything, finally you end up with this thing we call a picture, aren't they? But what I find interesting, like it seems to be coming from over there. Like, we go, oh, there's the clouds. It's like, no, that's just a bit of paint moving like that. We're the ones going cloud, tree. we're imputing all the stuff on it, and we get back what we impute. So I think, man, that's like karma, cause and effect, isn't it? You push it out and it comes back at you. This is like, so we go searching for an inherently existent self. The question is, why is unfindability of the self considered a breakthrough in meditation? And its answer is that, like not finding a real self, not finding a solid and independent self, is finding the true nature of reality. It's like I said, so we look in to find what's real, and we find this, the reality is an absence. And it's, they use the simile as realizing that the monster in the hallway is just a pile of laundry. And I thought, man, that was like me when I was a kid. I used to be so afraid. All it was a coat hanging over the back of a chair. I thought it was a man in my room. Anyway, let's do this last meditation. And again, just adjust your posture, get your back straight, drop your shoulders. Let your body breathe itself. I think our purpose for meditating on the wisdom realizing emptiness is to sort of cultivate this wisdom so that we have the capacity to free all beings from grasping at the illusory. Now, though we feel quite solid and real, can we find a findable self within the body? We do not find a findable self within the body. The self exists only through dependent designation. Being unable to find a self within the body is realizing the emptiness of the person. This is a gross of selflessness. There is no person independent of their body and mind. No owner, possessor. The idea that there is an owner, a possessor of the body and mind, something solid and real existing within us, is like a mirage. Right? It vividly appears to us, but it's not actually there. So when we search for a findable self, that does appear to us to be findable and real, what's the result of our analytical inquiry? We find an absence of a self-established object called I. This absence is called emptiness. This non-finding is like a sort of stainless sky where the ghost vanished. Now, if there isn't anything that has this solid essential nature, how do chariots or cars continue to function? Well, they function as labeled collections of parts. They have no intrinsic existence whatsoever. So cars and chariots, all phenomena exist only through the assembly of their parts, their function, and their name. So I wonder what sort of transformation might take place when we realize that our identity is much like a magical display. It's like an image on television. Our grasping and clinging will cease as the heart becomes more uncluttered and free from the clinging. And this release, this non-grasping, unties the knot of every conception we've ever held. It leaves us at an unconditioned and luminous peace. This is the place where we can rest. This is our refuge. As we're breathing in through your nostrils, exhale, just release. And bring your eyes back to the screen. So we've come to the end of our class. We've looked at these 13 questions. What have we got? We've got another, next week we've got another 18 to go with us, and I'll send them off to you soon. And if you just pass them off to everybody else, so thank you. Thank you. Okay, so let's, next week we have this. So let's now dedicate. So join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. In the prayer for the long life of His Holiness, the wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind, our Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, for the discovery of the authentic reincarnation may take place quickly. In holding and spreading the Mumi's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. An incomparable, venerable Guru, to you I make this request.